Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to great listeners and supporters of this program, including Joan Falber, Lee Ann Rayer, Sharon Warden, and Edward Mayfield. They're voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. Thank you. And we just gave our website a facelift. It's hopefully easier for you to navigate and use. And that tab is still there that says You Can Help. If you'd like to sign up for a voluntary subscription for as low as $5 a month, just go to peterbcollins.com. Our subject today, America's longest war continues in Afghanistan.
Islam is rising, the Christians mobilizing, the world is on its elbows and knees, it's forgotten the message and worships the creeds, the world is on its elbows.
Prophetic music from the late 1980s. That's a British band called The. Matt Johnson is the writer of that song called Armageddon Days Are Here Again. Islam is rising. Well, fascinating information coming out of a huge document dump, 92,000 classified documents related to the war in Afghanistan, published by the New York Times and other major newspapers, but fueled by leaks from a murky organization called WikiLeaks. And a lot of people have just figured out or learned about Julian Assange, who is the guy who runs the operation and invites people to send him documents to be leaked. Robert Perry joins us to talk about it, longtime journalist who's covered war and Bush family issues, to sum it up in an odd way, I guess. But he publishes now at consortiumnews.com. I invite you to visit the site. He's got a lot of great writers who are publishing there. And his own commentaries I find very powerful because Bob's got a great knowledge of history and helps us put things in that kind of context and perspective. Robert Perry, welcome back.
Thank you, Peter.
Have you read all 92,000 documents yet?
Well, I tried to get on the WikiLeaks site a few times and managed after some waiting a while to at least get onto the page and look around a bit, but it was rather slow. I think there was an awful lot of traffic they were getting. I did read the New York Times piece in detail and some others, so I reviewed some of the raw documents that they reprinted. So mm-hmm. I've a feel for it, but certainly I've not read the 92,000 pages.
Well, and I have read the New York Times coverage that came out late on Sunday and found that very interesting. And first, we need to acknowledge that these are documents that are often field reports and kind of intercepted communications. So we don't have the full story in many cases. Yet the information does help, I think, shape people's views. And we know that the majority of Americans have shifted against the war in Afghanistan, even as President Obama has committed more troops and renewed his own personal commitment to what I consider to be a folly. But we are getting confirmation here about the influence that Pakistan and its inter-services agency, the ISI, has on the Taliban on both sides of the border, the rampant corruption both in Kabul and across the countryside of Afghanistan, and the unfortunately common occurrence of deaths of civilians, not just in the crossfire, but often in these misguided attempts to use remote-controlled missiles and drones to do the work, and we often hit the wrong targets. So it's an interesting array of information. What did you glean from it, Bob, that hit you as real news?
Well, I think the texture of this is very important, which is what you're talking about. One can sort of see or hear secondhand some accounts from intelligence analysts or government officials, and it all seems rather bloodless. To actually see some of the raw material, whether it's soldiers who are under fire or whether the field reports regarding the killings of civilians, there's a good deal more. There's a rawness to that kind of information. It's more human, and therefore I think it has more impact on people, and should. And it's perhaps the kind of knowledge that Americans do need more of. The government, both the Bush administration and now the Obama administration, has tried to make this conflict as antiseptic as possible, in order to avoid having too many people become outraged over it. And I think having this as this sort of detail as a counterweight to that effort is valuable, even if there perhaps is nothing in here that is particularly shocking or surprising in the sense that we kind of knew much of this, but we knew it in a more remote way. This is in a more immediate way, and I think that serves a purpose.
And the reaction from the White House and the Pentagon is, no news here, keep moving. Don't bother, keep moving. and that makes me want to dig in even deeper to see if there are some nuggets here that they don't want us to see. And the way WikiLeaks did this with this huge single exposure or release, they gave the newspaper organizations a couple of weeks to digest it. I don't like other people to chew my food, and I like to investigate as much as I can on my own. So I think over time, there may be other things that surface from these documents that have not really been identified in the first pass.
Well, there's value in both, Peter. And I, as a journalist, I think it can be very helpful to have an expert, someone who knows the topic, who can give you the context for events that might not be apparent just from reading raw documents. And I think that's what journalists have tried to do. At least the better ones have tried to do throughout time is to both cite the raw material, but say, well, here's how this makes sense in the bigger picture. And sometimes there has been this attitude on the internet of just dumping material and assuming that the public can just sort of go through and understand it. And while I think it's valuable to do it, I think that there also it helps to have someone who is an honest broker going through this and saying, well, here's how this fits in, or here's how it doesn't. Sometimes if you see just raw documents, they don't make a lot of sense to you. But if you could place them in the fuller context, they'd mean a lot more. So I think there's a value in both, and one shouldn't necessarily say that it has no value when good journalists come in and try to provide that. And I think the New York Times, to its credit, did a pretty good job. It offered like 5 or 6 pages of coverage, and put many of these in a valuable context. And I think WikiLeaks was very smart to create this dynamic of somewhat of a competition by giving the material to the New York Times and to the Guardian in England and to Der Spiegel in Germany, and so it was impossible for one of the news organizations to essentially take a dive, which we've certainly seen happen in the past.
Yes,
but this was a way that it also invested these news organizations in the story. We've also seen cases where someone comes out with a lot of good material, I think, Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News back in 1996. And the big papers, instead of joining with that, then see it as a threat to their turf and go after that material and that journalist. So I think WikiLeaks was smart to do this, and it also provided it gave the news organizations a chance to provide the context that just the raw documents might lack.
One of the other reactions from the White House and from Robert Gibbs in particular is that, well, this relates to the period of time when this was Bush's war. And while some of these documents do run up through November of 2009, the White House tries to draw a bright line at December 1, which was the date when President Obama gave his speech at West Point, where he announced the so-called surge and increase in U.S. troops in Afghanistan, with this promise of a partial withdrawal starting just a year from now. And it's interesting because some of what Obama offered in that speech does not square with the information coming out of these WikiLeaks leaks. And, for instance, he tried to tie our presence in Afghanistan once again to 9/11 and to Al-Qaeda, when everybody knows that if there are Al-Qaeda members left in Afghanistan, they are not in substantial numbers and they're not part of the organized insurgency. The Taliban and an array of other insurgent forces, some loyal to warlords and, kind of independent operators, make up this this rather broad-based insurgency that we're encountering. And so I think it's interesting to compare the case that President Obama tried to make to justify his escalation in Afghanistan with the details that surface in the WikiLeaks package.
Yes, but I do think that the larger point here, and to me the most troubling point, is that that this shows in a sort of narrative form, as you sort of follow the war from the 2004 point when these documents begin through to 2009, the deterioration of the situation. And that really does fall on President Bush and the neocons and what they did in terms of war policy. There was, of course, after 9/11, there was the next month the attack on Afghanistan, which was done with minimal, essentially, American forces working with some of the anti-Taliban forces in Afghanistan and using heavy air power to drive the Taliban from Kabul. However, even as Osama bin Laden and his top lieutenants were allegedly, apparently held up at Tora Bora, the decision was made by President Bush, with the neocons pushing this, that the real target they wanted was Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. Mm-hmm. They had to essentially make up a case and deceive the American people to at least leave that impression, even if they tried to avoid saying that specifically. And they developed the case for the weapons of mass destruction and the support of terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. But what was clear is that that Bush's decision to pivot came very quick, really within days of Kabul falling. And so literally as the American troops who were working with the Afghan militia who had surrounded where Osama bin Laden was believed to be, the Central Command under Bush's instruction had turned its attention to preparing the war plan for Iraq. So as the American forces were seeking desperately to get reinforcements to block bin Laden's escape, the U.S. military had already started making the transition from that unfinished conflict to an invasion of a country that had nothing to do with anything, but was a target of choice for the neocons. Now, that's an important part of history to remember, and so we ended up trying to do Afghanistan on the cheap. Bin Laden and his top lieutenants did escape, and Bush essentially blundered when he went into Iraq, thinking that this, as the U.S. as the unipolar power, could do pretty much whatever it wanted in terms of reshaping this region. that bought time for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and other radical elements to reorganize and regroup. And some of the captured documents that were messages from Al-Qaeda Central to their allies in Iraq indicate that the goal was, once the Americans had foolishly blundered into Iraq, was to keep the Americans tied down in Iraq. There was the letter that was written by one of bin Laden's aides, known as Atiyah, who says that the goal is that prolonging the war in Iraq is in our interest. So the idea was to go slow, keep the Americans bogged down, while this other transition could occur back along the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. So there really, I think, is a serious threat that was allowed to get worse, and now I think perhaps is not something that can be dealt with, even if Obama gets his money to escalate 30,000 more troops in Afghanistan, up to about 100,000 American troops. That's there probably isn't a realistic way to deal with the resurgence of the Taliban, other than trying to work out as best a deal as possible. But there really is a danger if radical elements get control, a full control of Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, which was always the big threat, and it was one that Bush and the neocons recklessly ignored in favor of this other agenda they had of going into Iraq and then maybe getting regime change in Syria and Iran, and that was what they wanted. So they let this other problem get worse and worse and worse, and now the United States is stuck. The Obama administration has inherited a mess, and I don't think it's been particularly clever in how they've tried to respond to it. But I think Obama has been mostly concerned about his political flanks, that if he announced a complete pullout, he would come under such attack in Washington, where the neocons are still very powerful in terms of the news organizations, the op-ed pages, the talk shows, and so forth. He would have been excoriated, and the U.S. military would have attacked him. General McChrystal was leaking information about about what had to be done in terms of escalating. General Petraeus wanted the escalation. Secretary of State Clinton wanted the escalation. Defense Secretary Gates wanted the escalation. So for Obama to have gone against that he would have paid a very high political price, and I think he chose to sort of try to finesse it with this thing you mentioned, this speech he gave at West Point where he announced the escalation and then said, oh, but by in a year or so, or by the middle of 2011, we'll start our withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
So you ended up with a policy that doesn't really achieve what I think might be desirable, that is to stabilize this region somehow and actually make things worse. But the real difficulty is no one really wants to sit down at this point and say there has to be a deal, as unpleasant as it might be, with some of these forces that have opposed the United States and somewhat recklessly opposed the United States in that they allowed the Al-Qaeda people to have a base there back 10 years ago or so. So you do have this problem, and it's real, but it's not something that can probably be dealt with at this point unless people are willing to really swallow a not a very pleasant compromise, but that is something that politically is so hard to do with the forces that exist at Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Because to try to do that would open any politician who moves in that direction to accusations of defeatism, soft on terror, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can almost envision it. So Obama's tried to square the circle and hasn't been able to.
Robert Perry with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show, and I will reference in the show information a link to consortiumnews.com where you can read his article, How Bush Botched the Afghan War, which details much of the case that he just made. And I just want to put a finer point on it. The pivot date was November 21st of 2001, and you have gone back and compared some reporting from Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, with other information and been able to link that it was November 21st of 01 when Bush pulled Rumsfeld aside and said, I need a new plan to attack Iraq, and that Tommy Franks and the team at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida were relayed a message that same day, and that they were in the process of arranging air support for the Tora Bora effort when they were told to start to work on Iraq. And so that gives us an actual date, and you're correct that, you know, we had only begun the assault on Afghanistan, what, 2 to 3 weeks before that. So it was quite a quick move, and it underscores what the intentions of the neocons were at that time. But, Bob, coming back to President Obama and the situation that he has, he had a moment there when he fired General McChrystal to shuffle the deck a little bit. And instead, he really solidified the position that he took on December 1st last year, with one exception, and that is this promise of a partial withdrawal or a start to withdraw, or the door to withdraw opens in July of 2011, because General Petraeus, his new commander there, in rather deft commentary before Congress, basically said, well, that's optional.
That's right. I mean, the idea that it would be conditions-based, which I think the conditions are likely to be worse than summer of 2011 than they are today. So, it's essentially the argument that Bush always made about Iraq, that there should be this open-ended commitment. And I think, and I happen to disagree with the one of the basic points that's now widely accepted in Washington, the so-called successful surge,
sure,
which I think is a myth,
yeah,
relating to Iraq. Much more of it related to things that happened in 2006 before the surge started, the so-called Sunni awakening, the death of Zarqawi, the very brutal leader of Al-Qaeda, and the de facto ethnic cleansing that had occurred, where the Sunnis and Shiites had largely separated,
mm-hmm,
and so the surge of 30,000 or 40,000 American troops was a relatively minor element in all that. But the way Washington worked, that became the excuse. The other big factor that is ignored, is in terms of the drop in violence toward American troops, was once it became clear the U.S. was going to be forced to withdraw, which was being negotiated through 2008, the numbers dropped off dramatically in terms of Iraqis killing Americans. And in large part, that was the Americans had pulled back, they weren't fighting as much, and there was a recognition that they were on their way out. And so through the Status of Forces Agreement, which was signed at the end of 2008, this whole myth, which became a very dangerous myth, because it allowed the neocons in Washington to sort of reestablish themselves and say, see, we're right all along, look how great we are. So they cited this, and they also made Petraeus into this a water walker who could not be challenged. So that then played into the problems after the election. And I think the real crucial moment, the crucial mistakes that Obama made related to his staffing of the government during the transition. And we wrote extensively at consortiumnews.com about the problem of relying on Secretary Gates, a holdover from the Bush years, and Secretary of State Clinton, who was very hawkish on these matters. Obama took the attitude that he thought he was so articulate and clever that he could sort of handle all these very powerful personalities and get them to go in a direction he wanted. But when you staff a government with people who don't agree with you in terms of maybe having a more peaceful way of engaging that region, you're almost always going to lose, in part because these folks know how to play the power game. They know how to leak information when it works for them. They know they have a lot of friends in the media. They can put out information. We've seen recently a very remarkable story, which we also dealt with at the website, where General Petraeus was sending messages to a prominent neocon, sort of coordinating how they were going to approach some of these some issues relating to the Middle East. And so what you see here is this is a very savvy group of players that Obama insisted on keeping around rather than cleaning house, and they have really directed the policy in a way that was very similar to what the Bush approach. Refusing to do serious negotiations either with Iran or with the Taliban, and pushing ahead with essentially a military approach to these problems.
And Bob, I want to delve into something you raised a few minutes back here, in particular about Pakistan, Because, you know, my considered opinion is that we should write off Afghanistan, and we're not going to prevail there either militarily or politically. And while I am worried about human rights and particularly the rights of women, I don't think that we can maintain a military presence there on those issues alone. And yet my desire to see us get out of Afghanistan is tempered by my concerns about Pakistan. And to the extent that Afghanistan is a staging area for the United States to keep a military watch on Pakistan, there is some practical value to that. And we also, I think, need to be wary of the Islamic insurgencies, and that's plural, inside Pakistan, and the limited stability that that government has at this time. And, you know, since we're breaking international law to continually use drone attacks in Pakistan, where we have no authorization to use military force, I think I may have mentioned this to you once before, but on a practical level, I think the most important thing we could do is to independently secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons so that in the event of a civil war there or a further breakdown of the control of the central government, that our biggest risk is attenuated.
No, I think that really is the biggest strategic risk, not just to the United States, but to the world, that those nuclear weapons, which go back historically to another terribly misguided policy that Ronald Reagan and the first the first President Bush carried on in the 80s and early 90s, that it was a tremendously stupid approach toward Pakistan and Afghanistan in that period, even though in Washington world it's a highly regarded moment. But it really set the stage for these things. The Reagan administration allowed the Pakistanis to move ahead with their nuclear program as part of a payoff in exchange for them providing allowing the U.S. to use their territory to help arm the Afghan rebels fighting the Soviets. So that deal, which was really one of the most remarkably reckless in the history of the world, but Pakistan was allowed to develop nuclear weapons. It's a very unstable country. It is already an Islamic state. It has close relations with some of the most radical elements. That's one of the things that the WikiLeaks documents reveal in greater detail, is how much the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service, is connected to some of these rebel forces. And the reason for that is quite logical. Those forces have been used to fight India, which is Pakistan's regional bitter enemy. And their idea was to use the Taliban to keep Afghanistan essentially under Pakistani control, and to push more pro-Indian elements of Afghanistan away from the capital. So the Northern Alliance had much closer ties to India, and Pakistan wanted them out of power. So what you've had here is a regional power struggle that, because of all these gross miscalculations by U.S. administrations, particularly Reagan and Bush 1, and then, you know, Clinton didn't do much to help anything. In fact, he allowed things to sort of deteriorate further. And then Bush 2 sort of made things even far worse. So you have this development of a dangerous situation that is now very hard to get a handle on. And I agree that the one thing we probably, as a nation and as people of this planet, have to be concerned about is if truly reckless elements get control of those nuclear bombs.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the WikiLeaks documents support, and I'm basing this on the reports that I've read, I haven't been able to delve into the documents themselves, but what we're seeing is that there is more than winking and nodding, more than just passive acceptance, that it does appear that in certain instances that military leaders in Pakistan have been directly aware of or involved in different little incursions or activities that have taken place along the Afghan border and that include crossovers both of Afghans and Americans into Pakistan and Pakistani Taliban into Afghanistan. And it appears that whatever's developing from this is focused mostly on the fact that we give a lot of money to Pakistan and therefore we should be able to buy their loyalty. But to me, the fundamentals are troubling here, that people who we claim as our allies are actively supporting or aware of forces that are killing Americans as we speak.
Well, the Taliban was a creation of the Pakistani intelligence service. Al-Qaeda was essentially an offshoot of the U.S. Covert operation during the 1980s in Afghanistan, which, of course, the Pakistanis intelligence service played a central role in. So these folks are not, there's not a great deal of separation. There never has been. This is something that the American public doesn't understand very well, but it's extremely important. There's another key moment, and I happen to have been around at this time, in 1989 when the Soviets finally left Afghanistan. And there was a point when probably the last real hope for Afghanistan was to sort of strike a kind of a coalition government, some kind of negotiated deal between the old communist regime that was still in Kabul and some of the more responsible elements that the U.S. had been backing, these Islamist groups where religion was being used by the U.S. to sort of whip up public support against the regime in Kabul. So what you had, though, was an opportunity then, and this is what President Gorbachev of the Soviet Union wanted to do, but his approach for a coalition government was rejected by President George H.W. Bush. It was at that moment of this great triumphalism that we were beginning to feel in Washington that the United States could do anything, and why should it negotiate? Why should it even bother? It had its enemy, the Russians, on the run. It could dictate what it wanted, and the idea was that the communist government in Kabul would fall very quickly, and our guys would be in charge. And I talked to a CIA guy involved at the time, and I posed the question. I said, why does the United States care? I was with Newsweek at that point. I said, why would the United States even care whether Najibullah and the communists are still there in Kabul or whether these guys that we've been supporting, these Islamists, are in government or have some kind of coalition? And the answer was basically they wanted to see Najibullah, the communist leader, strung up by a light pole. That was the answer I got. And it was that kind of tough guy, arrogant triumphalism. We weren't going to settle for anything but total victory, total humiliation for the Soviets, control of Afghanistan. But what happened was that the U.S.-backed rebels were not that effective, and the communist government hung on. And they hung on really till after the Soviet Union collapsed in 91. And then they basically fell, but they worked with one of the more moderate elements, Massoud's group of Mujahideen. He was the guy more connected to India. So that's when, over time, the Pakistanis then worked with these young militants that they've been sort of grooming in the refugee camps in Pakistan and developed this group called the Taliban. And they ultimately took power in 96. So it was far into the Clinton years now when the Taliban finally took power. Najibullah, who was still around, he'd still been allowed to hang out there by Massoud, they literally dragged Najibullah. He was castrated, he was tortured, he was killed, and he was literally strung up by a light pole, just as the CIA guy I talked 2 years earlier had envisioned, although the time element wasn't quite what they thought would happen. So then you had this situation, which was really brought about by this arrogance of the Republican administration, both of Reagan and then Bush 1, thinking that the United States didn't have to make any deals with anybody. We could just sort of order everyone around. And what we ended up with was a far worse situation. And that has been the pattern here, this inability to make deals, because it's hard to make deals with people that are as obnoxious as the communist government was in Kabul or the Taliban. It's easier just to say we're going to crush them. But sometimes in trying to crush them, you end up with even worse situations. and worse situation. And we're now far down that road of worse situation. And as you point out, the worst situation could be that we also help destabilize the Pakistani government enough that the radical Islamists get control, and get control of the nuclear arsenal as well.
Yeah. Bob, one of the other issues that is detailed in the WikiLeaks documents is the rather widespread civilian death incidents that have occurred in Afghanistan. And McChrystal made a big deal of changing the rules of engagement. When he got fired, there was pushback from troops and generals saying we need to loosen these rules of engagement. Just in the last 24 hours, Hamid Karzai, who Richard Holbrooke refers to as the legitimate leader of Afghanistan, has complained once again of another attack that killed civilians. I believe 56 is the number of deaths that he is alleging at this point. The U.S. military has not agreed with the details of the number of fatalities or, I think, the incident itself. But putting aside those particulars, this is a very serious problem that we have as we attempt to win hearts and minds, and we continue to use night raids and drones and what we contend are accidental attacks that kill large numbers of civilians. This is just another reason why we simply don't have enough troops. Half a million or more is what it would take to really pacify Afghanistan, and we will never approach that, yet we pretend that we can do so with the phony claims of a victory in Marja and now the delayed attempts to take over Kandahar.
Well, in my view, part of this is that the myth of the successful surge in Iraq, which we were one of the few places, I guess, that were kept saying, hold it, that's not right. Although, ironically, Bob Woodward, in his last book about the Bush years, reached the same conclusion we did. Based on his interviews with some of the senior military people, he said that the surge itself was a rather minor part of what happened that changed the situation in Iraq. But the conventional wisdom of Washington was that it was the surge that did it, and Petraeus was a genius, and therefore any criticism of the surge was unacceptable. That led to this idea that, with a surge in Afghanistan, we can do the same thing as we did in Iraq. But it's not at all the same, it's operating from a mythical standard that only the people of Washington kind of have bought into, or at least they've been the leaders of buying into it, let's put it that way. So this idea that you can send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan and somehow get control of this situation, which has been allowed to worsen and worsen now for 8 years, is really not realistic. The difficult thing, though, is how do you sit down and actually engage with some of these people that some of the Taliban and other radical elements, and somehow work out some kind of deal that gives them some power, as offensive as that might be. But the idea of surging U.S. troops and increasing the level of violence, even if there is a little bit more restraint and certainly in ordering firepower brought in. What we saw also during the surge in Iraq, going back to one of the earlier disclosures from WikiLeaks from the same batch, apparently, was the video of in 2007 during the surge of American gunships just mowing down about a dozen or so Iraqi men as they walked down the street, including two Reuters journalists.
Yeah.
And that, I think, what gave another, again, sort of the ground sense, the real feel for what the surge meant. It meant killing the so-called MAMs, the military-age males. There was an approach of you killed enough of them and locked enough of them up, some of them are going to be insurgents, and therefore you're going to ultimately reduce the ability of the insurgency to do anything. Now the cost is that you're killing a lot of innocent people too, and frankly some of the people who are in the rebellion against the United States, we would in other circumstances consider them freedom fighters. But put that aside, that's what we're dealing with now with Afghanistan. And the same basic rules of engagement, which also come out in this a bit, which we've known about for some time, is to basically shoot and kill people who are identified as militants. And sometimes it's done when they're not armed. There have been cases where militants have been not even offering any resistance. They're alleged militants. They're identified as militants, and then they are executed by U.S. forces. And we've seen some of these things come up in court martials where basically these rules of engagement have been endorsed. And that also is reflected here in some of these documents, this idea of the killer capture list, which essentially mean hit list. So what you're dealing with is a very ugly situation where the United States, U.S. forces are being asked to carry out a very difficult and brutal mission where the outcome is not worthy of their sacrifice or the sacrifice of the people of Afghanistan at this point. But there have been, one way you have to understand, these miscalculations have gone back several decades now. I arguably begun by Jimmy Carter in a minor way, when he began sort of trying to cause trouble against the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul, escalated dramatically under Reagan, made worse by Bush 1, not really addressed very much by Clinton, and then made appreciably worse even further by Bush 2. So we are far down this road, and it's very difficult to figure a way out of it, especially when you consider the way Washington works, the dysfunctional nature of Washington. And it's so easy to be the tough guy and to make the tough statement, how you're not going to compromise, you're not going to do this, you're just going to go, you know, kill them, the old dead or alive approach that Bush took, which is still basically what the United States is doing. And it means killing civilians, it means killing people that are standing up for their country against foreign invaders, in their view. It means destroying a lot of lives and destroying much of this part of the world to achieve, I guess, the result that some people feel is still possible.
And Bob, finally, I want to ask you about the leaks themselves and the role of the alleged main leaker, Private Bradley Manning. He's an Army intelligence operative, and from what I understand, he's based in Iraq.
Was.
And he has acknowledged publicly that he was responsible for the release of the video, the turkey shoot that you referred to. And it's alleged that he had a role in this huge document leak. What do you think is appropriate here in terms of your view as a journalist? And do you expect a huge crackdown on whistleblowers and leakers by the Obama administration?
Well, perhaps regrettably, I think that may well happen. Basically, what happened with Manning is that he was, from what he told this person who ultimately turned him in, there were a certain amount of email exchanges that were made public, and he basically was very disturbed by what he was encountering in terms of U.S. policy in Iraq and also Afghanistan, and he said in these exchanges, whether or not it's true is obviously still, because it can be put in doubt, but he described turning over tens of thousands, I think he said 160,000 documents to WikiLeaks. So that does seem to be somewhat, it now seems to be more likely than when he first said it, because WikiLeaks has released 92,000 documents, and as well as this video, which was also attributed to Private Manning. If that's the case, Manning, of course, has been charged by the Army. He's facing possibly decades in prison. He represents, I think, if what we understand is true, another example of someone like Daniel Ellsberg, a person of conscience who decided that it was important for the public to know more of what was happening than they did. In that sense, I think he deserves a great deal of respect. And as a journalist, I think we don't protect sources as well as we should. I mean, sometimes we keep their names secret, but we don't feel that they deserve the kinds of First Amendment protections that we as journalists have. And I've always said that was a mistake. I think I've always felt it was one of the most important aspects of being a journalist dealing with investigative matters to give as much protection of all kinds to people who are willing to risk their careers, risk their liberty to get important information to the American people. So in that sense, I think Manning, if assuming his role is confirmed, much as Ellsberg's role was confirmed back in 1971 on the Pentagon Papers, I think that makes him somewhat of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
As far as how the government will respond, one can expect, I think, the government to crack down. Obama has increasingly wants to show to the neocons and to the various hawks in Washington that he's not some radical, he can be trusted, and that seems to be more important to him than in just doing the right thing, which I think has been the core problem of his 18 months in the White House to this degree. And you can go not just on foreign policy matters, but things like global warming, standing up for the public option on health, on the health reform.
Getting hammered repeatedly by Andrew Breitbart.
Right, but I think, you know, it's not imaginary. He does have enemies, and they're very well organized, well funded,
mm-hmm.
Extremely nasty, and willing to do pretty much anything, as we saw in the case of the Sherrod case recently,
mm-hmm.
to destroy people who get in their way, even small people, even people that aren't that well known who get in their way, to basically just to achieve their end goals. So I think Obama's facing that, but instead of trying to rally his own base, granted, sometimes that base is not very effective, but trying to rally the more progressive elements of the United States to bring about a new day and do what's necessary, he's tried to compromise and essentially turn on his base to sort of show that he's not one of them, which he thinks, I guess, will buy him some level of protection in the Washington power circles.
Well, and he thinks he can hold the base by appearing on a video at the Netroots Coast Convention and saying, oh, you know, change takes a long time.
Well, no question, change takes a lot of time. But, there have been a number of these issues where he has not been out leading the way. He's sort of taken a very passive role. He's allowed things to develop. He hasn't been using his bully pulpit in the way people might have thought he would. Given his ability to express himself very well and his how articulate he is, but he hasn't taken the lead on stuff, and I think that's partly out of fear that he's going to be called a radical, he's going to be called all these names, he's going to be called anyway, anti-business, and to a friend of terrorists, Muslim lover, whatever they're going to call him, and they've called him all those things and worse. He's afraid of that,
mm-hmm.
So I think he's tried to finesse it rather than confront it, and maybe attacking these disclosures will be just another way of showing that he's part of the team, which is not really, I think, what the country needs right now, but the country needs an awful lot if it's going to get out of these problems.
Robert Perry, always a pleasure to talk with you. I appreciate your commentary. I want people to read your work at consortiumnews.com. And you're a nonprofit journalism entity. I know you could use some cash so you could pay your writers. So to all my rich listeners, consortiumnews.com needs your help. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Share it with a friend and email me, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.